You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, April 2nd, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks. This is a Michael Thursday on the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live from our multiple quarantine locations across the greater New York area. On today's program, Harvey J.K., historian of the New Deal, is going to be talking about this moment in American history. Why are we still in the 1920s? Politically, with an authoritarian right, an absolutely failed center, and how we might, in his words, reclaim American history. Jobless claims rise to 6.6 million this week as we hurtle into a Great Depression. Ventilator stockpile in New York with one hitch. Thousands don't work. Usually a helpful thing to have them work. Protective gear in national stockpiles nationally are depleted, according to Department of Homeland Security officials. Key medical supplies were shipped from the U.S. manufacturers to foreign buyers, records show, even as other countries were consolidating national responses. And not only is Donald Trump not doing anything to stem the crisis in unemployment arising from the pandemic he ignored, which he allowed to turn into a crisis, he won't even reopen the piddling Obama exchanges to help get a few extra people health care. And we should always remember, everybody who's fought against Bernie's Medicare for All has, conservatively, another 10 million uninsured during a pandemic on their hands. Thanks, guys. Very, very well done. Nancy Pelosi says you should wash your hands, dance, and make some anemic talk about an infrastructure bill that has warmed over old demands. McConnell says it's not going anywhere as the national failure of leadership persists. Private equity baron is sitting on an empty Philadelphia hospital. He's in line for a huge tax gift thanks to the COVID corporate theft bailout bill. Private equity lobbyists were also involved in a $500 billion coronavirus bailout fund. And Andrew Cuomo, this is your hero. He's got the budget he wants with billions of cuts, Medicaid, no serious reform on prisons, even as coronavirus rips through the New York prison system. And of course, his core brand proposition, no tax increases for the ultra wealthy. Anthony Fauci has a security increase thanks to threats. Modi asked forgiveness for the poor as Bolsonaro keeps fighting reality and the left begins to consolidate against him in Brazil. Trump escalating coup war against Venezuela, tightening sanctions that are killing innocents in Iran, and a family is mourning the deaths of its family members in Somalia as U.S. drone strikes continue in that country. The empire grinds on, all that, and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Hello, Brendan. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Michael.
Talk about third love.
Howdy.
Let's do it.
How are you guys doing?
I'm good. Just stewing a little bit about certain things. I think anybody who has said any word or done any action against universal egalitarian health coverage should take a vow of silence until we have achieved that. And I mean that. I think that's the least they could probably do.
That is the bare minimum that they could do. And of course, many people in the public spotlight who've done this who fought against you having guaranteed health care coverage and therefore increasing deaths and risks across this country, quite literally have blood on their hands, and usually for money. I'm also reminded of Jay Carney, Barack Obama's former press secretary, who is now at Amazon, defending an Amazon worker in New York City who was attempting, and everybody should remember, Whole Foods workers are on a sick strike this week. I really would, if you can, certainly this week, observe the Amazon boycott. I certainly am. There was a union organizer who, by all appearances, fired in retaliation by Amazon. And the company's spin that they're putting out to the public is not that they punished a worker who wanted to protect himself and his fellow workers from the coronavirus, but that he was violating distancing rules that the company was putting in place. Now, of course, there's a lot of reporting that Amazon is implementing next to nothing to protect people in their factories from coronavirus, that there aren't masks and gloves in the numbers that are needed. There's barely Purell, I've read in certain places. And Jay Carney, Obama's former press secretary, was certainly there to not only defend the company in general, but personally demonize this guy, a working class person who, you know, I don't know, doesn't want to get deathly ill during a pandemic. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think, you know, an attitude of complete negativity is obviously what, you know, they want, as it were. And at the same time, like, America is a failed state. And I think, you know, the first step of change is acceptance of reality. That is where we are. And obviously, we've been heading here aggressively for decades.
It's not Yankee branded makeshift personal protective equipment. That's not a successful state.
Right. It's not New York hand sanitizer, which is apparently just rebottled from other companies by prisoners.
For the propaganda value,
which everybody seems very hungry to help Andrew Cuomo with. You know, I wouldn't stan any of these people, but it's really important to note that, you know, Andrew Cuomo, who's very unpopular here in general, and is just a look, if you care about poor working class people, he's a horrific governor and aggressively anti-labor. You know, look, he knows how to do TV, and he's in the media capital of the world. Gavin Newsom and Jay Inslee, in this very narrow sense, certainly not politicians I would put on a pedestal. They've done a lot better job with all this stuff, and they're not getting political capital out of it. I mean, the Cuomo thing is just pure performance. But that's what a fair amount of the punditocracy wants, just performance. They obviously don't care about, I don't know, cutting Medicaid during a pandemic. This was cool. I'm, you know, not always excited about the sort of latest Fox News, you know, antics. And sometimes when people get on there and kind of break the set on Fox, it's cool. But, you know, who knows? I mean, my point is that in all of the media mess, this actually really stood out. This is Dr. Rishi Desai. He was on Fox with Martha McCollum. This has been making the rounds. And I think, this is great, obviously, to go to the heart of Trump Republican propaganda. But I also would love to see him, educate folks on the other side of the divide who are, you know, praising South Korea without wanting to mimic any of South Korea's policies like national health care. At any rate, Rishi did, Dr. Desai, I should say, did a great job here. And they clearly didn't know how to handle it.
large-scale testing. Now, what we hear every night is that the tests, that there are millions of tests available, and yet we don't have that pinprick blood test that you can just sort of get, you know, at your local doctor and know in 15 minutes. But they're working on it.
Yeah, they're working on it. They should have been working on it for months. So the fact is, we knew about this from the WHO when? December 31st, 2019. So last year, we knew about this. We knew coronavirus is coming. We knew it was a respiratory disease. We knew it was person-to-person. Why is it that it's this week that the FDA finally approved these kind of new Abbott lab testing, which, by the way, is one test at a time? It's a great test, but it's one test at a time. It's different than the labs that are doing mass testing, right? So this is a wonderful test. Don't get me wrong, but it's one test per 15 minutes. That's wonderful, but it's not the same volume that you really need. This is better for kind of outpatient clinics and things like that. We needed this months ago. You look at Korea, South Korea and the U.S. had their first official confirmed case on the same date, January 19th. Mm. That means since January 19th, you look at what South Korea did and what we did. Their population is 1/6 of ours. Look at the cases they have. Look at the mortality they have. It's a trifle compared to what we're dealing with right now because we've had a very weak response and they had a really strong response. Mm-hmm.
Doctor, thank you. Very interesting to talk to you, Dr. Desai. Hope you'll come back as we move through this difficult period in the country. Dr. Desai, thank you very much, sir.
Hope you come back. Yeah. You just completely laid bare all of the bullshit that we've been pushing on this channel from the administration for months now while they cause all of these preventable deaths. I would recommend, I mean, I think people should really, really definitely, you know, look at what South Korea is doing, both in terms of the response rate now, but again, also the health system in place that allows them to move with that kind of speed. You know, somehow Bernie let Joe Biden get away with saying that, you know, oh, well, Italy has universal health care, but look at what's going on with them. And of course, the problem was not that they have health care for everybody. That's essential. That's why Spain is nationalizing its hospitals. The point was that Italy didn't respond with speed. So in the United States, we have no speed, no infrastructure, no single payer. That's why we're a failed state. And that's why we're leading in terms of fatality rates and infections. So that's where we are, folks. And joining us now, what I like about Zoom is people really are just joining us now. There is no, they arrive. They arrive as if from space. Harvey J.K. is with us. He's a historian at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, author of many books, including Take Back Our History, Zero Books. Professor K, how are you?
Good to see you, Michael.
Good to see you. How are things there?
Well, it's relatively calm to the extent that we don't have a lot of cases yet in Brown County and Northeast Wisconsin and Green Bay. But it's also the case, there's an irony in all this, is that on the one hand, we're just coming out of winter, so streets are generally empty anyhow of pedestrians. So one didn't know. Today, we're actually going to be spring-like conditions, bright and sunny. I expect a lot of people to be outside, but it's nothing like New York, nothing at all. But we're all staying indoors. We're all hunkering down and then taking our walks.
Right.
And I'm teaching, you know, as all my colleagues are, by way of online activities, whether some are actually doing lecturing online. I don't do that, but staying in contact with the students.
How important is it that we, obviously, when things are safe, but I just want to put this out there. I think there's, you know, from the perspective of labor, from the perspective of work, from the perspective of the health of our culture, we shouldn't get too used to doing everything online. And specifically with education, we already have these, you know, decades long, you know, undermining of public education, undermining of the teaching craft, the horrific treatment of adjuncts and graduate students. I want to add here in this litany, Daniel Bessner, talking about, some institutions not covering graduate students' health care when we go into the summer. Really, really just egregious, disgusting market logic behavior in higher education. And how concerned are you that after a couple of months of this the crisis becomes the next rollout of shutting down more classrooms, undermining more investment in teaching, of course, the broader attack on social sciences and the humanities? What, as a historian and as a real teacher, what do you think about that?
Okay, so to put it in historical perspective, I've been watching this unfold for almost 45 years. I mean, we definitely have seen a reduced investment in public higher education, and this state is a prime example of it. We've had, many a times when even Democrats have been involved in cutting the budgets, but especially Republicans have slashed into the budgets and taken away longstanding powers of faculty authority over curriculum and hiring of administrators and so on. So I can tell you that my colleagues and I are very worried about the implications of all of this. For a start, because we're all dispersed, it authorizes, or at least seems to authorize, administrators and state administrators as well to take decisions that are not necessarily morally or intellectually theirs to make. But the other thing is, of course, is that, I assume that it's already in their minds, what are we going to do about the fall semester? And for all I can readily imagine that they're going to try to issue edicts of everybody moving into an online mode for an extended length of time. I don't do that. But I'm not going to complain about my own situation. What I am going to say is my colleagues are not happy about it. They're even more worried than I am because they're decidedly younger than I am. But they're also worried because the students suffer. And we've already seen it. Students are actually yearning and missing their class. They're yearning for their class. They're actually missing their classes for that kind of personal exchange. Zoom cannot replace a seminar room. It can't even replace a lecture hall, where a student raises a hand and you take a while. And if you don't get everything done, to hell with it, you don't get it done. So yeah, there's decidedly anxiety among the professorial classes. And you know how those online things often work? Well, they tape record lectures, and all those low-priced pseudo universities that are online, they're just literally replaying tape upon tape upon tape. And you can imagine how Republicans salivate. Hell, some of them probably invested heavily in such things.
Yeah, and I want to actually first let's get some business out of the way that's urgent and important. But I want to loop back to this war on history, war on education, as both a danger in terms of the future, but also an explanation of America as a failed state today, which I think it is. We need to start thinking of it in those terms, but. You were just sharing something with me, and there's just this flood of news. We passed this bailout package. We've talked about it extensively. Basically, it's just a massive wealth theft and monopoly drive for the corporate sector. It does some bare stop gaps for the Great Depression economy, but it's a giant theft. And one top line, by the way, is never believe this spin about the Republicans embracing populism. It doesn't matter whether they, have some people that might say some interesting things about supply chains or whatever on various outlets. At the end of the day, they are here to serve the corporate oligarchy. And Donald Trump is obviously an expression of that. But can you talk specifically about this move with Steve Mnuchin, and we might even have a petition we can sign, guys, that specifically has to do with protecting about 1 million jobs in the airline industry, which should be taken care of by a multi-trillion-dollar package.
Well, there was an arrangement made in the bailout, the CARES Act, that was led in many ways by labor unions to have this inserted, that if the federal government is going to bail out the airlines industry, the monies that go to the airlines industry should immediately go into the workers' pay. That is, the workers' pay and the workers' benefits. In other words, keep workers on the job. Pay them even if it means pay them to not work. And by the way, that's I'm going to do something that I've often criticized Bernie for doing too often, but it is the case that European countries have done just this,
right,
where you're not throwing people out into unemployment. You're not going to put them in a dependent kind of position. You're going to keep them on the payroll. And in this country, it becomes all the more essential to do that because you and I, we all know that if you're lucky enough to have benefits, the benefits in this country come from being on the job. And therefore, you're going to lose your benefits along the way. So here's the thing. So they made an arrangement that the airline industries would receive bailouts, but those bailouts would go to the workers. Now, you and I both know that if there are any number of good reasons to nationalize or take stake in industries, but that's not the Republican plan until right now. And here's what they're talking about doing. Mnuchin never liked the idea of empowering workers, of keeping them on the job. You know, look, the Republican plan, the right-wing Republican plan, the corporate model is to make workers as dependent as you can, to have authority and power over them for the sake of profits and merely for the sake of power itself. So now Mnuchin is talking about the possibility of finagling this whole arrangement and taking stake, equity stake in the airlines. If he does that, the airlines are going to balk and they are not going to pay the workers. As a consequence, up to 2 million airline employees could literally be thrown onto the unemployment rolls. And by the way, there are lots of consequences. One consequence is the fact that it makes workers all the more dependent and it creates chaos out there. I mean, the unemployment rolls growing and growing is not a healthy thing. It also centralizes a kind of authority and power which was not actually granted in the Department of the Treasury and therefore in the Trump administration. And look, I'm going to be honest. My biggest fear in so much of this stuff is the endeavor, the ambitions of the Trump administration, which has already shown itself to be hungry for this kind of thing for these past 3 years, that they'll want to centralize and centralize and centralize power and authority. So there is this effort, okay, led by the labor union, especially the airlines unions, airline flight attendants headed by Sarah Nelson. There's a place they can go to online. I sent to Brendan the tweet with the link. I hope
do we have that, guys? It's an action. I can IM it to you, Brendan.
Yeah, it's in the chat.
Good.
Okay,
good.
Can we just make that, put that on screen for everybody for a second?
Yep, 1 second.
Just so people know, because this is very important. You know, we got to keep the big picture, but we also have to move aggressively at all of these fast-moving pieces.
Yeah, you know, Michael, there's a key word here. This is the word that we're going to have to use more and more often, a word we've all too often forgotten, and the word is solidarity.
Right.
There right. You got it.
Right. All right, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Michael. That's been on my mind, I can tell.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, and I'll tweet that out later, and obviously you can follow Professor K. He'll tweet that out. So it seemed we were just talking before we went on air, and we were talking about,
the long war against higher ed and humanities and social sciences.
The long yes. Well, no, we were on for that, but came on for the Majority Report, we're in the 1920s in some respects right now. And there's no, we have Bernie, and Bernie matters, and Bernie's popular. There's obviously Biden is very likely going to be the nominee. And if he's not, I mean, consider somebody horrific like Cuomo as well, right? Like, I mean, we're in a very, very bad shape.
Yeah.
What if we are in the 1920s, what does that tell us about the next several years from the perspective of, you know, how bad it can get to what might need to happen to get us out of this predicament?
Well, if we think 1920s, there's a great, the school books never really tell the 20s right. The term roaring 20s, it was roaring for capital.
Right.
Okay, roaring for capital. And if you look at the 1920s, it's actually the last decade of the Gilded Age that goes all the way back into the late 19th century. And the Gilded Age, and we're in at least the second Gilded Age, involved corporate power, concentration of power and wealth, and literally inequality growing. Now, do you mind if I mention a few statistics about this?
Of course not.
Okay, the statistics in the 20s seem to imply that household income was rising. So who would complain? But what it doesn't really reveal is that household income usually meant multiple workers in the family, in contrast to the past where it would have been a single worker, perhaps. So the thing is, inequality was increasing, and the stress and the pressure on working families. And by the way, farmers never recovered from the post-war recession, post-World War I recession. So you had this really growing inequality, wealth getting wealthier. We know that kind of story. And here's the thing. I mean, economists, progressive economists, liberal economists, socialist economists actually consider that the greatest cause of the Great Depression was the fact that workers couldn't even buy the goods and services they were producing themselves. They called it a lack of purchasing power. Now, here we are. We're thrown in already to gross inequalities. We're confronting right now growing unemployment. I mean, was it last week 3.3 million? Now we're up to 6.6 million. And we're just at the beginning of this whole process. And if you look on a map, there are certain sections of the country, the New York area and others, which have suffered this the most so far. The Southeast, hell, they're acting like it isn't even happening, but they're gonna see what that means. And out here in the upper Midwest as well, because Detroit and Chicago have become places where the number of cases have increased significantly. So the thing is, already inside of this crash, let's call it that, we're going to see it intensify because we've seen for the past 45 years a class war on labor, which has smashed labor unions. And what that means is the capacity of workers to resist and to fight is going to be seriously hampered by the experience of those years. And how are we going to do it all the more? This is an even more unusual situation. We're all indoors, right? And we're going to have to be creative. We're going to really have to be creative in terms of organizing online, creating solidarities online, joining unions online. I mean, joining associations that support unions online. And we're going to have to figure out ways of creating, if you like, I won't even use the word a new resistance because that's practically a word.
They destroyed that word.
Yeah, destroyed that word. We're going to have to create a new kind of preparatory struggle. We're going to have to be ready, you might say.
Well, so then how can you fit things like the Amazon strikes, the Pittsburgh sanitation workers, the rent strikes? So there's a lot of very good things that are happening because of really horrible things happening.
Yes.
There's an absolute necessity. I mean,
right.
Another thing this bailout did, of course, was no rent suspension. Andrew Cuomo vetoed a very modest piece of legislation here that would have frozen rent for 3 months. So things are happening. How do those acts of necessity start to congeal into something that's systemic from the grassroots?
Yeah, well, can I go back into history a bit for that?
Yeah, of course.
Mind? Okay,
please.
In 1930, 1931, American working people were not passive, okay? They weren't out in mass necessarily, but there was a lot of turbulence, and the powers that be knew the threats that were coming into the public sector, so into the public realm. So, for example, let's start here in the upper Midwest, where I live in Wisconsin. It was the case that farmers were so utterly fed up with already more than a decade of suffering, you might say, of enduring low prices. And now with the Great Depression, 30, 31, they organized what was called, and we shouldn't assume this was any kind of summer camp thing, the Farmers Holiday Association. What it meant was they were going to keep commodities from getting to the market. Those who joined literally did not send their stuff into market. But they also went out on highways. They stopped trucks and they poured milk out when necessary. Now, when asked about what they were doing, these farmers said, "This is our Boston Tea Party. This is our protest moment. Then let's go to the bigger cities." Well, communists, socialists, and radicals organized respectively unemployed leagues which staged protests and rallies on a fairly vast scale, thousands of people, and they marched. It's also the case that unions themselves in Detroit and elsewhere, I mean, there still was something of an auto industry despite the Depression. These folks organized, making demands on addressing their needs and the needs of the community. And moreover, most importantly, they were demanding a voice. Okay, keep in mind, there were no unions recognized inside of those industries of the 20s and early 30s, other than maybe company unions. Okay, then it's also the case that the bonus marchers went to Washington. The bonus marchers were the World War I veterans who had been promised a bonus for their service to be delivered in 1945. Who would have thought it would actually be the end of World War II at that time, if it ever happened?
Right.
And they just, and they're unemployed. They have families and they are scared. What are we going to do? Well, they got organized. They sent out word, we're going to march on Washington. And from all across the country, by rail, by car, by truck, whatever form it took, even if it meant getting in a wagon with horses, they descended upon Washington, D.C., demanding the payment of the bonus then. Now, I want to point out to people, because we have this idea that in the past, races were always divided. The bonus marchers were an integrated force who occupied Washington in an integrated fashion. Right. Now, they were smashed, and this is the warning. MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, okay, Roosevelt, I think, called him the most dangerous man in America, okay? MacArthur led troops, armed troops, to attack the bonus marchers. His lieutenants were Eisenhower and Patton, I believe. This is 1932. My year, I think, was 32, early 32. Now, they dispersed. They dispersed. And by the way, one of the groups made its way to New York City, and they actually set up a camp on the shoreline of the Hudson River around 79th Street. And there are shacks, and there are pictures available of this. I should have probably brought them along for the show.
No, it's fine. People can look them up. This is great.
And it's called the camp. Now, this is the thing that – this is why I came across this by accident. They actually named their camp Camp Thomas Paine. Wow. I hope I can see a smile on your face now.
Yeah, you can. That's right. I love it.
Okay. And what did that mean? They called it Camp Thomas Paine. They were laying claim. They were taking hold of American history to assert themselves even in defeat. And that's significant. Moreover, it was an integrated camp down on the shoreline. And the New York Times, once upon a time, was a really great newspaper. They actually ran a series of stories covering Camp Thomas Paine, very sympathetic stories, makes for great literature. I'd like some playwright should actually write a play based on the many articles, and I won't go too far into that right now. But it is the case that they were very well organized. They every day got up, assembled in military ranks to show their discipline, and then they all went off across the city to get whatever jobs they could, to bring back whatever they could, and then they shared it collectively and cooperatively. Camp Thomas Paine. The tragic side of that is that Robert Moses, the great city planner, was determined not to let these kinds of things get in the way of building, what's it called? The Hudson River Park, the Henry Hudson, the West Side Highway.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So literally,
I think that's the Henry Hudson, right?
That is the Henry Hudson, yeah. Right? Well, at a certain point, it's West Side and then becomes Henry Hudson. Now, there's sort of a strange thing about this. Right next to the Camp Thomas Paine was, I think it was called the Riverside Yacht Club. Okay, a motorized yacht club. So, but Moses didn't give any preference. He literally drove out the yacht club and these unemployed worker veterans. But of course, the yacht club could find its way higher up.
The yacht club could figure it out.
Yeah, but it's the case that workers were already mobilizing, farmers were already mobilizing, and Franklin Roosevelt was well aware of this stuff. And there's an interesting thing he said in 1931 as he looked around as governor of New York, okay? And he said, I think it's time for this country to go fairly radical for a generation. And thus, even if he was not himself a socialist, he began to articulate, based on his own experience as a politician and his work during the war, First World War, and let us not forget, this was a man who was in a wheelchair. He knew from his conversations with socialist worker organizers in New York City, women who were organizing for the ILGWU and other unions, he knew that if you don't have health care, you are in deep trouble. Right. So when Roosevelt entered the White House, sorry, am I going on too long?
No, I love it. I want to move backwards and forwards because. Yes. So we have this moment. I think we've had many other conversations where we've complexified the New Deal and there's very necessary criticisms, and there's also very, very necessary acknowledgments of the enormous accomplishment of it.
I'm with you.
And your work is obviously an indispensable part of it. And I do want people, as an example, to know, in one of my favorite examples, that, President Lula, as an example, certainly read Roosevelt. And that this was a Nestor Kirchner. I remember an interview with Oliver Stone, who was the center-left Argentinian leader, just a moment that's kind of frozen in my mind because it's so depressing. Talking with Oliver Stone between 2000, right before the inauguration in 2009 of President Obama, and he's talking about George Bush and the horror of the Bush era from the perspective of imperialism. And then he looked and he said, but I really hope that President Obama is the next FDR. So I just want people to know that even as FDR needs to be interrogated and critiqued and all the rest of it without a doubt, not only is there an American progressive tradition, there's also, from my favorite angle, an internationalist respect for FDR as well, including in, leaders in the South. But
I can just say.
Yeah, please go ahead. I did too much there, but I have a question, but go ahead.
I think you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Because British socialists at the time were already making contact, not only with leftists in America, but also with Franklin Roosevelt. And I think this is an important thing that we really had failed to appreciate these all too many years. Roosevelt transformed the meaning of the word liberalism, because in many ways he probably knew that if he went too far left rhetorically, he was going to have even more hatred spewed his way than he ended up getting. And I can tell you that if you look at FDR's, we know his tragic mistakes and the degree to which he empowers forces we may not have wanted empowered. But the more important thing is that he empowers working people. And if you look closely at what he called liberalism, it is social democracy. And I'm willing to argue about that with anyone.
Oh, I don't think there's any. I mean, I think that there's, I think there's a bigger argument about those other forces and the compromises and the international dimension. Of course, what he called is liberalism is social democracy. And that's actually the only reason that we still have some positive associations with the word liberal is because of those accomplishments. I don't think that part's debatable at all. But anyways, so there are these accomplishments, and then they kind of ride through with the contradictions, I think, reaching their height in the 60s of the horrific imperial policies of Kennedy and LBJ, the genocidal slaughter in Vietnam, Laos and Vietnam, and alongside, the real heightening of the contradictions of butter at home, guns abroad. Yeah. There is some progress in terms of the next phase of the New Deal in the 60s. And then there, of course, Nixon is this criminal and this, but he sort of keeps, he says, we're all Keynesians now. But then starting with Carter, this consensus is broken. And we're in a time now, and I'm really, on one hand, there's the very simple idea and a very important idea of the idea of getting back into the discourse, the idea of completing an American New Deal, which everybody from Adolf Reed to you have sort of put forward in various different ways and ways that can go extremely radical. And then I want to couple that with the fact that, clearly in the last several decades, and we're really reaching the heights now, that the Democratic Party, I don't think it's that they don't know that history. I think they quite clearly, as Marshall Steinbaum pointed out today, they want a base and a party of essentially mostly affluent suburban white voters. They are not interested in the new working class. They are not interested in the urban or the rural in any significant way. And I don't, and I think that's a product of the globalization of capital, of political consultants replacing labor parties, all the work that Stephanie Mudge and Mark Blythe have done and really showing how these center-left parties have changed institutionally. So what's the bridge there if you want to reclaim that legacy, but also recognize that on a political and institutional level, it isn't necessarily an educational or it's a power one. It's a real shift in terms of what they see as their constituency.
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting question. One thing we saw in these recent primaries is the degree to which African Americans have actually rallied, especially older African Americans, have rallied to Biden.
Sure.
And I think it's interesting that, you know, folks like Michael Eric Dyson, and right, has endorsed Biden. I mean, but when push came to shove, I think the answer was, well, you know, we vote pragmatically. African Americans vote pragmatically. They weren't convinced that Bernie could produce on the kinds of things he promised. I lay that out because this is important. I think it's imperative that the kinds of things we've seen emerging in Bernie's movement, you know, I mean, I think it's imperative that the multiracial and it's been this integrated force. It's really remarkable. And we've got to figure out a way actually to build on that and not merely be satisfied with it.
And I think the African American vote, and actually I'll announce it soon. We're going to do a specific stream on this with Adolph Reed and some other people about just the problems of even just the media narrative around one singular African American vote is very essentializing and problematic. But even regardless of that, I mean, I think especially in a place like South Carolina, it would make a lot of sense that people across the board who are voting Democratic, and obviously including many older African American voters, would have a sense of frankly voting defensively. Yeah. And being very concerned about how extreme a threat we're in. So to me, I think that story is important, and it's very important to complexify, and we need to talk about it. But
yeah.
What I'm specifically interested in right now is Nancy Pelosi. Zach Carter put out something earlier about, you know, some new something. I'm forgetting the legislation, but something with suburban home ownership. The point being that, of course, the Democratic Party, I think that's the very old arrangement. Look, if you're a person of color, if you have a remnant connection with a decimated labor union, who else are you going to vote for? The other side absolutely wants to destroy you. We'll occasionally maybe give you a little respite. But I want specifically to look at the dynamic of a leadership of the Democratic Party that really, I think at the end of the day, not only is its axis not of some sort of working class, it doesn't want it to be. And it wants to build a center base out of the suburbs. That's where it sees its future.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with you about. Oh, sorry.
I'm just curious the answer to. Yeah, I know you're not.
I
mean, yeah.
I should make clear. I don't know if everyone follows. I hope they do. The Michael Brooks Show is closely, but you and I are pretty close. Okay. So I didn't think that. I agreed with what you said about the Democratic Party leadership is doing. So I didn't know how much I needed to go on from that. But I think it is the case that we've got to figure out. We have to figure out how we go forward so as not necessarily to forget. And I'm not one of these advocates of white versus black or people of color working class. But we have got to figure out how we're going to actually engage the white working class that last time was very keen on Bernie. And I think that's part of our task. How do we, and by the way, I actually think that the more we move into a decidedly social democratic, and when I say social democratic, I am not talking liberalism. Okay. I'm talking social democracy, and it's truly both American and internationalist form. And I think that it's imperative that we work out how to articulate that and also how to organize around that. And I think this is the moment that we need to do it. In other words, I know we've got the horizon, and you've got a broader horizon, a longer horizon than I do, frankly. But I think we are in a, knock on wood, man.
Yeah, knock on wood. We'll see.
Okay. But I do think it's imperative that these kind of conversations take place now, but that my biggest fear is that we not break down into the left of the past, the divisions of the past, that we build a left that's comprehensive, but that we on the left have a major say in its progress. Okay, that's my point. And to do that, we have to master. I'm not just talking about, I do think there's a process of historical education, but I think it's also a matter not just of what rhetoric we use, but what we aspire to do. And I think if we can't aspire to address the immediate and long-term interests of working people, then we're in deep trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. Professor K, as a final question, we talk rightly, and we can go back in history to the 80s. We can look at Lori Jarrett's work on the broader neoliberal assault on the public health infrastructure. And then, of course, we can talk about the Trump administration dismantling pandemic responses and all of this, you know, these horrific decisions that have led to where we are. Do you think that there is, it's not a direct analogy, obviously, but I want to do a cultural analogy of that the assault on history is a discipline. And so that the fact that people don't know about A. Philip Randolph, or they don't even know that, you know, the March for Jobs and Justice was this incredible radical event of dismantling American apartheid and delivering that social democracy for all, because of course it wasn't in the first iteration. Having any understanding of the history of labor movement in this country that isn't like, you know, an addendum character in some, you know, fun gangster movie.
Yeah.
What is the consequence, and how are we seeing it play out today, of not knowing our history?
Well, look, we're bombarded by rhetoric right now, okay, in the midst of the crisis. This may not be what you have in mind, but I can tell you what's been on my mind. So immediately, for example, we have seen columns appear that grab hold of FDR. And they talk about FDR who reassured Americans, FDR who mobilized Americans to work in the New Deal. But what they don't talk about is that FDR himself was believed it was imperative for him to engage and encourage working people and to have labor unions capable of organizing on a grand scale, not only so they could defend themselves in the workplace and make demands on things, but literally so they could push him. He knew that you do not create liberalism, social democracy, socialism, whatever, if your leaders themselves are not compelled to do things. So when he took office, okay, in the very first National Industrial Recovery Act, for all of its failings, was written in labor's right to organize. Now, there were flaws in it, and they returned to that in 1935. But in 1935, Roosevelt himself said, new laws in themselves do not bring the millennium. It is what he said was his people went out and called on not only workers, but housewives and others to organize. So that, you know, somebody caught me yesterday when I did the rising with Crystal, and somebody sent me a note after and said, you use the word mobilize a lot. How about organize? And I said, sorry, I was using a term that I think of that's comprehensive, but I think that's imperative.
I think mobilize might be more to the point, maybe, at any rate. But yeah, so just to underline it, if you know history, there's no way you can write, can Andrew Cuomo be the next FDR with a straight face?
That, you know, I'm close to Katrina, and that one really, I actually went, whoa, you know.
I mean, honestly, I didn't even know that Katrina Vandenhoevel wrote it. I just saw the headline and thought, are you kidding me? I mean, you know, I'm sure Katrina, you know, has good intentions with it, but I mean, no, quite literally not. He's fighting for Medicaid cuts and to depress labor in the state right now.
Yeah, well,
even if he's reassuring us in press conferences.
Well, yeah. Look, obviously, if there was a lefty working at CNN as Cuomo speaking to the cameras, and they give him, what, 2 hours a day, it seems, at least an hour, underneath the bar should be reading, this is the same man who was looking to shut hospitals in Brooklyn.
Right.
Right?
There it is. Professor Harvey J.K., please stay safe, stay healthy, read history. And retake back our history.
Take hold of our history.
Take hold of our history. Sorry, I have it. See, you think I have a longer horizon. My memory is completely failing. All right, Professor K.
Can't wait to see you in person, Michael. And please, if anyone's interested, Harvey JK on Twitter.
Yes, we'll have a link.
Thank you.
Thanks, Professor K.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Professor K is leaving the meeting. Welcome back, folks. We are a minute away from the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report if you can. And obviously be in touch with Sam if you need any kind of help or deals or anything like that. Similarly, go to patreon.com/TMBS. Massive amount of histories and shows and content if you are in a position where you have the means and you're at home. This is definitely the time to jump in. You should also subscribe to our YouTube channel where we do a lot of bonus streams and a lot of stuff. Tuesday, Abby Martin and Liz Franzik were on the show, and we had there's a lot going on content-wise with TMBS, including me starting to discipline myself to not use the word content anymore. Patreon.com/TMBS. My book is also available for pre-order, Against the Web, Cosmopolitan Answer to the New Right. There's a link on the majority.fm homepage. Matt! That's a camera.
Hello, okay. Everybody. And Jamie, you can bring your camera and everything live too if you want.
Okay, Jamie is here. Matt?
Yeah, she'll join us in a second here. Okay, cool. Yeah, I recorded a new literary hangover last night with Alex and Grace. Grace stayed up until about 2 a.m. England time to record it. We did The Widow Ranter, which is a 1689 play by Aphra Behn, who was basically the first paid women playwright. And it's about she was also a spy for Charles II. And she sort of rewrites history of Bacon's Rebellion in a way that makes the Tory heroic individual the sort of central story of that rebellion. So it's an interesting bit of psychological rewriting of and mythologizing of history by the state there. So look forward to that on Saturday. Patreon.com/literary hangover.
Sweet. Jamie.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yeah. We can hear you, but we can't see you.
Can't see you yet.
Oh, it says I can't start my video because the host has stopped it.
Okay, I did stop that in the middle of it. Let me see how I can figure out how to fix that now.
Why don't you just call? Can she just come right back?
No, here we go. Try it now, Jamie.
Okay, right. Good. There she is.
I put on clothes and everything, guys. I was really looking forward to seeing you all face to face. So
glad everybody's healthy so far.
Yeah,
me too. Seriously, I've been vacillating wildly back and forth between thinking this disease poses no threat to me personally and thinking that I will definitely be the statistical outlier millennial who dies of this thing. So
we got to just think about, we've got to think about our aged brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
I am.
Yeah.
I am, and I just dropped off some groceries for a friend who's sick with some of the symptoms yesterday. So,
I think people definitely overlearned the lesson that it only harms old people. You do not want to get. Actually, Brandon Sutton, friend of the show, to be down with it with coronavirus symptoms. Shout out Brandon. We hope to have him on to talk about that, but it can put you down regardless of. And he. Very healthy guy.
He's literally Chad Vigorous.
Yeah. So if it can put Chad Vigorous down, it can put down anybody.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's not a question of
But
if
yes.
If you get it.
But you're probably not going to die.
The problem is the social spread.
You'll feel, but everybody will feel like horrible. I know people who,
Well, what happens is you have to think about, who did I expose to this?
No. Like, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's the
existentially
bigger point.
Horrifying. Yeah.
No, that's the bigger point, of course.
My primary fear is dying prematurely in a dumb way. That's probably my biggest fear. So that kind of triggers that a little bit in me. But then I remember I probably wouldn't die if I got it. I would just feel like I was going to die and then I'd be okay.
I mean, you don't want to have a ventilator or get intubated these days with supplies so low. So knock on wood, everybody.
It really hammered it home to me.
America's a failed state.
A friend of a friend actually died of it the other day.
Oh, gosh.
She was 50 years old. She didn't have any underlying conditions. And she would have survived, but the hospital was totally out of ventilators. Oh, God. So that's really sad and really scary.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is like, remember those jokes? And they started at the beginning of this crisis, but the empty store shelves jokes, like, look at, this is what socialism is. Like, those jokes aren't going to even be able to be made by those people anymore, because those images and shortages is just something we live with now. It's our reality. We've come back down to reality, folks.
Back down to earth. I forget who tweeted this, but somebody said America is a third world country with a Gucci belt.
Absolutely.
Pretty 100%. Much.
Yep. Yep. Nailed it.
And we've got the president we deserve.
Well, that was very Sam-like of you.
Yeah, no, I don't blame the voters.
Yeah. Personally, I don't deserve that guy.
No, I'm saying, like, not as people, but as a country.
As
a, you said. It's a very fitting guy to be in charge of that.
You can tell that's true. Given it, the trajectory of founding fathers, Trump actually isn't as far off from, say, a Nathaniel Bacon or a Washington as people might think.
Exactly.
Just love
and one. Even literary. The literary guy said it himself. Not that far off.
Yeah, John Ray Washington. President. John Washington, who eventually put down his, inheritance to George. Earned his money by, one, dispossessing Native Americans to a point where it led to, like, a huge amount of strife in the just politically in the colony, and also marrying a widow that had a bunch of money from a previous dude. So
I don't really see the problem with the second part.
Very Trump-like is what I'm saying. Like,
I don't think Trump would marry a widow for money, though. He might. I feel like that would be the type of
thing.
That's
true. Like, he actually has it.
And then you'll die. Because that's what John Kerry did that, and that's why he broke his leg biking.
Yeah, John Washington.
John Washington, John Kerry, losers.
Yeah. That's a Steven Crowder move for sure.
Jamie, what's up about the Antifada?
All right. So this week on the Antifada, I'm very excited about this one. We had on Peter Fraze, who is a Jacobin columnist, and he wrote a book called Four Futures: Life After Capitalism, that feels very relevant right now. And we talked to him about which of the four futures we might be headed towards. Spoiler alert, we talked a lot about the bad one, the exterminism future, wherein we maintain the hierarchy that we have now, in addition to conditions of scarcity. And also automation makes it so that, you know, while the ruling class used to probably despise the working class, but they still needed us to do all the work because they're not going to do it themselves, as automation makes that less and less of a thing and they need people less, they're probably just going to try to get rid of us. So it was a really optimistic, inspiring talk. No, it was. I mean, we talked about the communism future as well, because we are a communist podcast and we care about that. And I think it's important to put, like, some visions on our vision board of how the world could be better, and we shouldn't just give up at trying to make it better. But yeah, it was a good conversation. Check it out.
Sweet. Brendan is asking people to break quarantine to see his band jam. Brendan, go ahead.
That is not true. I'm filing a lawsuit against Michael for libel.
Brendan's calling it an immune boost herd jam.
Yeah, they've got that. They've got the thing the church has that zaps the germs out of the air.
Yeah, it's kind of like,
yeah. Me and Rodney Howard Brown down at the river in Tampa.
You have to go up for like two drinks a night, and that's because that's where the germ zapper is. So you
get exactly. It's like the Kudlow approach.
Well, those things are expensive too.
Yeah. You got tight. You gotta drink it out. That's what I get.
And you do some medicinal meth and you're fine.
I love how Kudlow was the most sober I ever saw him on the day that they were essentially announcing, like, this bailout's gonna just be like a multi-trillion dollar like slush fund. He was kind of like, all right, we're doing the big robbery. It's early beer today. I'm focused.
We're gonna wait till 3 or 2:45.
Okay, we're doing it. We're stealing the entire treasury. All right. All right. So only Budweiser. All right. He's got to stay focused.
Yeah, you got to get yourself together for the big robbery.
He's listening to like Winston Churchill.
He's listening to Winston Churchill's smacking. I thought it was going to be tomorrow. I would have had wine. I actually rob better when I drink a little. Oh. All right, guys. We're going to go to the fun half. I get no IMs, no calls, because we don't have the setup, but we do have some more sound, and you know, we're gonna hang out a little bit. Please, everybody, as best you can, stay safe, stay healthy. If you are working, because you are any sort of essential worker, we not only salute you, we will do whatever small part we can play to get you paid. At any rate, and covered and everything else. All right. See you on the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.